Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Leonard Leo. I'm Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society. Thank you for joining us this morning for this panel discussion on the U.S. Attorney's controversy. By now, of course, all of you have probably heard a fair amount about the controversy that's been brewing. And much of that press attention, of course, is focused on who said what and to whom and when. And the purpose of this program is to step back a little bit and move away from some of that political intrigue which we see in the press from day to day, and to have a discussion that focuses primarily on some of the policy, legal, and constitutional issues that surround this current controversy. And we have a very distinguished and knowledgeable panel to help walk us through some of those issues and to begin a discussion or a dialogue amongst themselves and then hopefully with those of you in the audience. What I will do is begin by introducing the speakers, and then we will have remarks from each of them with a little back and forth to follow, and then hopefully ample time for any Q&A or commentary that those of you in the audience may have. First up on the panel will be Andrew McCarthy, who's director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy Center for Law and Counterterrorism. Mr. McCarthy is a former federal prosecutor and is a contributor at National Review Online. From 1993 to 1996, while an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of New York, Mr. McCarthy led the prosecution against the jihad organization of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, in which a dozen Islamic militants were convicted of conducting a war of urban terrorism against the United States that included the 1993 World Trade Center bombings and a plot to bomb some New York City landmarks. Mr. McCarthy has also made major contributions to the prosecutions of the bombers of the United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania and the Millennium Plot attack at Los Angeles International Airport. Following the September 11th attacks, Mr. McCarthy supervised the U.S. Attorney's Anti-Terrorism Command Post in New York City. And from 1999 through 2003, he was the Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District's Satellite Office, responsible for federal law enforcement in six counties of northern New York City. Mr. McCarthy is going to play a bit of a dual role here today. He's going to begin with a narrative, objective overview of sort of some of the facts and where we are right now, and then offer some commentary as well. Mr. Mark Agras will follow Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Agras is a senior fellow at the Center for the American Progress, where he focuses on the Constitution, separation of powers, terrorism and civil liberties, and the rule of law. Prior to joining the Center, Mr. Agras was counsel and legislative director to Congressman William Delahunt of Massachusetts from 97 to 2003. He previously served as top aide to Massachusetts Congressman Jerry Studs and practiced international law with the Washington Office of Jones Day. I've known Mark for a number of years, and while he was on Capitol Hill, he played a prominent role in shaping laws on civil and constitutional rights, terrorism and civil liberties, and a number of other areas. He's been very active in the civil society world as well, serving as an officer of the ABA's section of individual rights and as a member of the Board of Governors of the ABA. To my immediate left and next on the speaker's list is Edward Whalen. Mr. Whalen is the president and chief executive officer of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He directs that center's program on the Constitution, the courts, and the culture. His areas of expertise include constitutional law and the judicial confirmation process, and he's a frequent contributor to National Review Online and has his own blog called Online's Bench Memos blog, where he does a lot of work and writing on judicial nominations. Mr. Whalen was a leading commentator on the nominations of both John Roberts and Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. Prior to this career in the public interest world, Mr. Whalen was a member of the Department of Justice, where he served as the principal deputy assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. He also had an important stint with the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, where he served as general counsel under Senator Orrin Hatch. Prior to practicing law privately for a period of time, he was a law clerk to Justice Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. Finally, we have Professor Jonathan Turley, who is the J.B. and Maurice Shapiro Professor of Public Interest Law and the Director of the Environmental Law Advocacy Center at GW Law School. Sorry about that. He's a nationally recognized legal scholar, written extensively on issues of constitutional law, criminal procedure, tort law. Began at Tulane Law School, joined the GW Law faculty in 1990, was the youngest chaired professor in that school's history. He's written over three dozen academic articles in a number of leading law reviews, and significantly, in Judge Posner's recent study on the 100 most cited public intellectuals, ranked 38th, which is pretty good standing for Judge Posner. He's a member of the USA Today Board of Contributors. He writes prolifically in the popular press. And has a good deal of private practice experience as well, having served as counsel in a number of notable cases, including his representation of the Area 51 workers in Nevada, nuclear couriers at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the Rocky Flats grand jury testimony, and a number of other very high-profile civil and criminal matters. So we thank you for your participation this morning, and we will begin with opening remarks by Mr. McCarthy. You can sit or stand, whichever is most comfortable for you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and in such distinguished company, and as always, I'm grateful to the Federalist Society for organizing this event on what has become, surprisingly to me, I must say, a very important public issue and controversy. As Leonard mentioned, I'm going to try to, in an even-handed way, I hope, lay out what I think are the general facts that go to this controversy and that we need to consider. I'd start preliminarily by noting that the United States attorneys are the top federal law enforcement officers in their respective federal districts, and there are 94 such districts throughout the country. They are, under the Constitution, executive branch officers, and there are several things of importance that flow from that. First and foremost, they do not exercise their own authority. Under our Constitution, the executive authority is committed completely to the President of the United States, and the United States attorneys in their districts, although they are the top federal law enforcement officers in their district, they do exercise not their own authority, but the authority of the President of the United States. They are nominated under our Constitution by the President, but they may not assume their offices until they've been confirmed by the Senate. Neither Senate approval nor congressional approval of any kind, however, is required for them to be removed. The expression that we've heard quite commonly, especially over the last several weeks, is that they serve at the pleasure of the president's the pleasure of the president, at least as a legal matter. Now, in terms of the controversy that has developed, over the last several months, eight United States attorneys have been removed from their positions. One of them, Bud Cummins of Arkansas, was removed in approximately mid-2006. The other seven who are relevant to this controversy were removed in basically in one fell swoop at the end of last year, in December of 2006. The removals obviously have provoked a political storm, and the firings have caused heated outcry in particularly the Senate, but also in the House, particularly centered in the House and the Judiciary Committee. I would suggest that it should be no surprise that the removal of United States attorneys has caused political controversy in Congress, because Congress, and in particular senators, are intimately involved as a routine matter in the selection of United States attorneys in their district. As a legal matter, as I said, the United States attorneys are appointees of the president, and in theory, he doesn't need to consult with Congress in order to place them in those positions. As a practical matter, and this has been so for eons, the placement of United States attorneys in districts is typically a collaborative process between the executive branch and the legislative branch, particularly members of the Senate, who over the years have actually been able to exercise a practical veto authority, virtually at least, on appointees in their political district. So presidents, generally speaking, will not select United States attorneys unless they know that they can, or have good reason to think that they can, get confirmed by the Senate. Home state senators in particular have always been very much involved in the selection process. In terms of this particular controversy, not only has it become a hot controversy because it touches on, I think, what the legislative branch views as its political prerogatives, but the Justice Department itself has played a critical role in exacerbating the problem, and it certainly is a problem at this point, by providing multiple explanations for the firings. At times, some of those explanations by top Justice Department officials have seemed internally contradictory. At times, the representations that have been made have been at odds, to say the least, with the paper trail that grew up in the government by virtue of email and exchange of memoranda, et cetera, particularly with respect to how much White House involvement there was in the selection, first in the decision to actually remove U.S. attorneys, and then, of course, the selection of their replacements. I would note at this point, editorially, that it's somewhat surprising to me, having, and I should underscore, I guess, that I worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York for over 18 years, and I worked under, in that span, six different United States attorneys. And it is surprising to me, to say the least, to hear the complaint about, or the inquiry even, about whether there was White House involvement in the removal or selection of United States attorneys. The removal or selection of United States attorneys is essentially a White House decision. In fact, if anybody other than the president is making the decision, that would be more problematic than any alternative I can think of. But in any event, we're now on the brink of a constitutional crisis stemming out of this controversy. Congress, pursuing its oversight authority over the Justice Department, has not only demanded testimony and documentary evidence from top Justice Department officials, and I should note that they have gotten testimony and lots of documentary evidence from top Justice Department officials and have been promised more in the ensuing days. But Congress, in both of the judiciary committees, in the Senate and the House Judiciary Committee, have now authorized subpoenas for the president's top advisors, which creates a profound separation of powers dispute and controversy. I would suggest then that for this morning, we have four main issues that we have to explore. The first is, what is the proper basis for removal by the President of the United States of executive branch officials, and in particular United States attorneys? Secondly, are there any limits, any legal limits, on the president in terms of exercising his removal authority? Third, we need to probe what is the proper scope of congressional review and oversight in this particular matter, which goes to congressional review and oversight of the Justice Department. And finally, with respect to that oversight, are there any legal limits on what Congress can and should ask for? Excuse me. In terms of the proper basis for removal by the president of executive branch officials and the United States attorneys in particular, I would argue that subject to one potential qualification, there are no limits on the presidential authority to remove United States attorneys. As I mentioned at the outset, United States attorneys are delegates of the president. They don't exercise independent power. They exercise the president's power. For that reason, the president has to be able to remove them at will. Not only is the power relation relevant here, but the political responsibilities at issue here also tend in the direction of allowing the president the authority at will to remove people. We operate on, in our criminal justice system, a system of prosecutorial discretion. We don't, as some legal systems do, purport to have the authorities leap in and prosecute any time they become aware of a violation of the criminal law. Instead, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of different potential federal violations. We have sparse resources to pursue those, and we have always left it up to the executive branch to make a decision about what criminal transactions are worth pursuing, which ones aren't, and what the priority should be for channeling the limited resources that are available to the federal government for investigating and prosecuting crime. Those calculations about what our priorities should be are inherently political decisions, and they are in chief made by the president, usually in conjunction with the attorney general, in terms of setting what the priorities for enforcement will be. The removal authority that the president has over United States attorneys is thus crucial, because the only way that the president can actually enforce the political decision that has been made about what the priorities for enforcement will be, the only way he can, as a practical matter, enforce that important political judgment is to be able to remove United States attorneys who do not align themselves with the priorities that the administration wants to pursue. In microcosm, I would suggest an analogy to you. Imagine any United States attorney's office where the district United States attorney decided, for example, that street-level narcotics trafficking was going to be a major priority of the office. If you had individual United States attorneys in the office who basically refused to pursue those kinds of cases because they preferred to do, you know, fraud cases or health care cases or what have you, I can assure you that those assistant United States attorneys would be short-timers. They would be removed by the district United States attorney, and that would be an appropriate judgment to make because the United States attorney is the chief officer in the district and has to be able to set priorities within the office. Similarly, the president has to be able to set priorities nationally for the enforcement of the federal law and is obviously entitled to remove United States attorneys if they do not adhere to the judgment that the president and the attorney general have made about enforcement priorities. I would also suggest to you that there's nothing new under the sun about that. It's something that's been going on for many, many years. It's surprising for someone familiar with the way the Justice Department works to hear hue and cry about the politicization of law enforcement. I was an assistant U.S. attorney in New York in 1999 when, for example, a controversy arose within the Justice Department over a case, I believe it was in the Eastern District of Virginia, called the Dickerson case, in which the United States attorney in that district won a conviction in a case where the defendant had not been given Miranda warnings, but his will had not been overborne, and the U.S. attorney had availed herself of a provision of the federal law which allowed confessions to be admitted even if Miranda had been violated, as long as the court could find in a bottom-line way that the defendant's will had not been overborne. Miranda, of course, is a sacred cow of sorts I'd say a sacred cow it was in those days to at least the Justice Department under Attorney General Reno and to a lot of people who are followers of criminal law enforcement and tend to come down on the side of civil liberties when there are disputes between liberties and enforcement issues. And the Dickerson controversy erupted a big fight in the Justice Department over whether the Justice Department would take the law enforcement position, favored by many of the police agencies, and actually try to defend the conviction, or take the position that Miranda was binding law and that it was actually part of the Fifth Amendment guarantee. The bottom line of the controversy was that the Justice Department ended up abandoning the conviction and enforcing and arguing in the Supreme Court that the conviction had to be overturned, basically directing the over the objection of the District United States Attorney, giving pride of place to Miranda over the conviction that was won in that case. There was spirited debate about what we ought to do in connection with that, but I don't recall ever anybody suggesting that it was remotely inappropriate for the Justice Department to be dictating to the United States Attorney what position the government should take in court. The argument was over whether it was a wise choice or not, but not over the right of the hierarchy at Justice to actually enforce that choice. Let me just briefly say, I think to the extent that there are limits on the President's authority, the only conceivable one I can think of is one rooted in corruption or obstruction of justice. If it turned out that United States attorneys' positions were, for example, being sold in a bribery scheme, or more, I suppose, realistically, although one hopes you would never have an instance of this, if United States attorneys were actually being removed because the White House or the Justice Department was concerned about a corruption investigation against the party in power, I would suggest that that would be a serious problem. It would be a violation of the obstruction laws, and arguably I think it is a limitation on the President's ability to remove. But short of that kind of behavior, and notwithstanding the document dump that we've had in this case, there hasn't at this point been any evidence that those types of things are afoot. I would say that the President's authority in this area is unreviewable. In terms of Congress, I think we must concede that Congress has very broad oversight authority over the Department of Justice. Congress's oversight authority is obviously not limited by inquiring into whether the people at the Justice Department are complying with the law or whether laws have been violated. Congress obviously has broad authority to probe how the Justice Department is being run, including whether it's being run competently. It obviously has authority to probe into whether the Justice Department, the priorities that the Justice Department are serving, whether those are the priorities that the American people should want to have served. I would again stress that that is also a political calculation, and another instance of underscoring that prosecution, at least on a macro level, is inherently a political undertaking. When I say that, I want to again be understood not to be saying that it's proper to have political interference in a criminal case. But what I am saying again is that the prosecution is a matter of choosing enforcement priorities, and the choice of enforcement priorities is inherently a political calculation. I would argue that there are limits on what Congress can do in its oversight function. One important one I think that we need to explore is that Congress's oversight function is intended for the carrying out of its legislative authorities under the Constitution. Congress is not there and does not have legislative oversight authority in order to be a substitute for a federal grand jury. It's not Congress's job to investigate crime or probe crime. Obviously, whether crimes have been committed, for example, whether the removal of United States attorneys was to obstruct any judicial process, is something that's relevant to Congress's general oversight responsibilities. But Congress's main function is to legislate, and its oversight function, the investigations that it's permitted to carry out in that function, are not law enforcement functions. They are they're permitted to delve into how the Justice Department is being run in order to satisfy the American people that it's being run properly and to make any laws that are appropriate to make in order to assure that that is the case. The other important limitation that I would suggest here is the one that I think is the key one that we're here to talk about today, which is the privilege that principals in the political branches and indeed throughout the government must have of confidentiality with their top advisors. In terms of good governance, we want our top officials, the people who carry out policy, to be able to confide in smart, creative people so that they can come up with the best solutions. That's the kind of advice that you are not going to get if people in the context of giving advice believe that they're have cause to believe that they're going to be subpoenaed and asked about the things that they advise their principals to do. Currently, Congress is trying to get the president's top advisors, and in this context we're talking, I think, about Karl Rove and Harriet Myers, the top political advisor and one-time White House counsel, to weigh in on whether the White House was involved and to what extent the White House was involved in the removal of the United States attorneys. I would suggest that that's a terrible mistake to go down that road. It obviously was a political decision, so the White House should have been involved in it in the first place. But more importantly, the Congress can get the information that it needs to carry out any legitimate role that it has here through the oversight of the Justice Department. It doesn't need to invade the relationship between the president and his top advisors. We shouldn't want that relationship to be invaded for good government reasons. And there's no limiting principle. If the president's top advisors now have to expose their confidential communications with the president, there's no real reason why that should be limited to a Republican presidential administration. It would be a principle that would now lead to the possibility of top advisors to members of Congress being probed over legislative decisions. It could even reach into the relationship between federal judges and their clerks. I think it's a dangerous road to go down in terms of good governance. It's a disastrous road to go down, and I would argue strongly that it oughtn't be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Mark Agres.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great to be here with you, and I always appreciate the efforts that you make to put together not only interesting panels, but ideologically diverse ones. And Andy and I also are old friends, and he's somebody for whom I have enormous regard. I think if one can only hope that all prosecutors are as conscientious as he was. Let me make a few observations. There's a lot that I agree with in what Andy has said. a few things I disagree with, particularly when it comes to the nature and scope of executive privilege. Certainly plenty for us to sort of talk about. First, let me identify a few themes that I think we've all been hearing in the editorial pages and in the news accounts. Andy touched on some of them in his recital. The first of them is that U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president. Does that mean he can hire and fire them as he sees fit? Well, as a purely legal matter, I think the answer is clearly yes, he can. There's nothing to stop him from doing so, and his authority is probably unreviewable in strictly legal and constitutional terms. There are a couple of qualifications, though. First, of course, the president ought not to be able to install U.S. attorneys without what the Constitution requires, which is Senate confirmation. And that has been an issue. That's one that Andy hasn't touched on, but it's an underlying issue because of the amendment that was worked by the Patriot Act that essentially allows for interim appointees to hold their interim jobs on a permanent basis without any Senate role. That has been a point of contention, of course, because the Attorney General said at one point he would never do this. He would never use that provision to try to circumvent Senate review, Senate confirmation process. But then, of course, that's precisely what was done. And so that's one concern, and obviously it's been a concern for Congress because now both the House and the Senate, by very large majorities, have voted to repeal that provision. It's my understanding that the president will not oppose that repeal. So we will go back to a situation where interim appointees do have to be confirmed by the Senate if they want to stay in office beyond the statutory period. So there is a Senate role, as with judgeships, as with ambassadorships. The president has a wide prerogative to pick whomever he pleases as a nominee. But that nominee has to be vetted through the system of checks and balances in order to be a permanent appointment. The second qualification is that while the president has the power to hire and fire U.S. attorneys, there are prudential reasons why a president may or may not wish to do so, or even be in a position to do so. And this goes back to what I think Andy properly identified as a kind of intersection between law and politics. These are quintessentially political judgments, political decisions, just as the decision as to what U.S. attorneys should do once they become U.S. attorneys in setting priorities in their region is quintessentially a political judgment as much as it's a legal one. So we always have to bear that in mind. And I would say that it can be legal and yet improper and unseemly for a president to fire a United States attorney under some circumstances. Now, what would those circumstances be? We can look at the range of different possibilities, different explanations, different hypotheses for why this took place in these eight districts. The first answer that was given, of course, was poor performance. Nobody questions that you can fire a U.S. attorney for poor performance. It's still an exceedingly rare occurrence. In fact, the Congressional Research Service has studied this question and has determined that of 468 confirmed United States attorneys over the past quarter century, only 10 of them left office involuntarily for reasons other than a change in administration until, of course, these eight firings. So in the course of a few weeks, we have doubled the number of U.S. attorneys dismissed from their jobs in the prior 25 years. In fact, according to CIRS, in all but two of those cases, the dismissals were based on serious personal or professional misconduct. Obviously, there's no question that did not happen here. So we're not really talking about poor performance, and we're not really talking about malfeasance. Second explanation, they wanted somebody else in the job. Well, we know that that was true in at least one circumstance, the Bud Cummins case in Arkansas that Andy alluded to. That's been acknowledged, it's been admitted, and it's not really in question. It's also possible that Margaret Chiara in Michigan was relieved of her job for a similar reason. It's still unclear why she was removed. Third possibility is that there were policy differences between the White House, the Justice Department, main justice, and certain U.S. attorneys. Maybe they just didn't get it. Maybe they just weren't with the program. I guess my sense is that while that may be regrettable, depending on what you think about the program or not, that is also not improper. The president ought to be able to remove somebody who isn't fulfilling those kinds of political expectations. Fourth possibility, they weren't on the team. We've heard a lot about this. They weren't loyal Bushies, which is, of course, what the phrase that's come into the popular press. Political loyalty of some kind, a kind of felty. I would argue that that is not an admissible basis. Again, legally, it's unquestionable that the president can do what he wishes, but it is not and should not be the practice in this country to fire career professionals for that kind of a reason. And finally, that they were unhappy with particular prosecutions or failures to prosecute. That, of course, is the most potentially most serious possible reason. It's the one that really is behind all of the investigating that's going on right now. The possibility in places like San Diego and elsewhere, Seattle, that the failure of a U.S. attorney to prosecute particular people or people of the other party, or the insistence on those people in carrying out prosecutions of people within the president's own party, may very well have been the reason for some of these dismissals. The situation of U.S. Attorney McKay in Seattle and of U.S. Attorney Lamb in San Diego both suggest that this is at least a possibility. I'm not prepared to say that it was the case. That's what we need to find out. But it may very well have taken place, and the best indication we have of that is the fact that members of Congress sought to influence. I failed to mention the Iglesias case in New Mexico, similar story, where there were efforts to contact and potentially to influence the course of prosecutions by members of Congress, something that for those of us who've spent many years up there on Capitol Hill, we know is a red flag. It is something you never do. You never want to either interfere in a prosecution or give the appearance that you are interfering in a prosecution. That, of course, is a separate matter. That doesn't affect the administration so much as it affects those particular congressional offices. There are ethical rules, and there may, again, be obstruction of justice issues at stake there. So those are the possibilities, and I guess I would say that one needs to carefully distinguish the valid reasons from the invalid ones. Second thing one hears, we said they serve at the pleasure of the president. The other thing we hear a lot is these are political appointees. They can be hired, they can be fired, they're political. And to that, I guess I would say yes and no. Federal prosecutors are not ordinary political appointees. They wield immense power to protect families and communities from harm, power to destroy innocent lives and reputations. They can erode the rule of law, or they can reinforce it. They can shake public confidence in our system of justice, or they can reaffirm it. Attorney General Robert Jackson, 1940, in a speech many of you are doubtless familiar with, said that the prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous. Secondly, these people, these U.S. attorneys, are the embodiment not only of the Justice Department and the administration, but of the system of justice in this country, and they have to be above reproach. That's why it's essential that they have that they be seasoned professionals and not just political hacks. They have to be people who will do more than simply follow the lead of the president who appointed them. That's why they're subject to Senate confirmation in the first place. Policy differences are one thing. Political preferences are another. And if they find that the people who were fired were dismissed because of who they were or were not prosecuting, it will have enormous political repercussions, and it should. Third, these dismissals are common practice. We hear that quite a bit. As I mentioned earlier, CRS has done a study. It's not so. Yes, it's true that when a new administration comes in, it has become the practice to dismiss all or most of the U.S. attorneys serving for the predecessor's term. That is one thing, but to interrupt U.S. attorney's term in mid-course for anything other than cause is certainly not the practice, even if it is, again, legally permissible. The last thing, of course, we hear is it wasn't illegal. It may have been the wrong thing to do, may have been the right thing to do, but they didn't break any laws. Well, we don't yet know the answer to that. It may have been illegal if it turns out that these things were done to obstruct prosecutions or intimidate prosecutors into either bringing prosecutions or failing to bring them. Again, this doesn't just affect the eight prosecutors who are no longer prosecuting. It also affects all of the prosecutors who were retained and are obviously not unaware of the consequences for towing the line, if you will. The fact that Monica Goodling, the DOJ official, has now announced that she will be invoking the Fifth Amendment when called to testify, obviously this is her right to do, and one should make no judgment about her innocence or guilt of any crime. And yet it obviously suggests that at least one central participant in this story is concerned that laws may indeed have been broken, and I think that obviously raises the bar. Whether the laws were broken, though, really isn't the question. The question is whether the Department of Justice and the President should be held to a higher standard in matters of this kind, and I think most Americans would believe that they should be. Finally, if I can just take a minute on executive privilege, it seems to me that I believe that executive privilege has its proper place in shielding the administration from unwarranted fishing expeditions, from intrusive investigations that seem to be going nowhere. We've had enough of those from both parties. And I don't think that it serves the public interest to engage in that practice. However, the fact is that that privilege is not an absolute privilege. It never has been. It must give way under certain circumstances when Congress really does have a focused inquiry pursuant to an authorized investigation where the committee has proper jurisdiction. They do have a right to hear from members, senior members of the president's inner circle. I don't think that they should be immune or exempt from testifying under any circumstances. I don't think the law or our tradition supports that. And just in terms of practice, and perhaps I'll end with this, another CRS report that says that presidential advisors have testified before congressional committees at least 73 times since 1944, including 47 times during the Clinton administration alone on such matters as Whitewater and the savings and loan scandal and the travel office and so on. Where there are issues of potential wrongdoing or malfeasance, I may have a slight disagreement with Andy on this. Obviously, I do agree that it's not the role of Congress to pursue criminal prosecutions, but it is the role of Congress to investigate allegations of misconduct by White House officials where those allegations are in any sense credible. Unlike executive branch agencies and departments, the White House has no inspector general to do that job. It is only the Congress that can investigate abuses and provide some degree of oversight and accountability. That's a power that should be used with care, with appropriate sensitivity to the balance of the executive and the legislative powers. But ultimately, again, that is a political question, and it is for the political branches to reach an accommodation as to what degree of oversight and investigative power is appropriate under the circumstances.
Thank you, Mark. Mr. Whelan.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm not going to defend the wisdom or the fairness of the administration's decision to dismiss the 8 U.S. attorneys. I want to make that clear from the outset. It may well be that some or all of the fired U.S. attorneys were doing a fine job, and it may well be that the best decision would have been to leave them in place. I'm also certainly not defending the public explanations that administration officials have offered for the dismissals. Indeed, the fact that these explanations seem to have ignited the controversy is compelling evidence of their inadequacy. It's also understandable that the dismissed U.S. attorneys would feel aggrieved by some of the explanations. I'd instead like to make and develop 2 points. First, I don't think that the evidence surrounding the dismissals remotely suggests scandal. And second, I'll spend more time on this, I think Congress's so-called oversight authority to investigate the dismissals is very weak and doesn't justify the subpoenas and demands for information that have been made. It doesn't justify them to any official, much less the White House officials. On the question of no scandal, look, is it conceivable that if we had a scorched earth investigation, we would find that one or more of these dismissals was improperly motivated under the standards that Mark set forth? Sure, it's possible. We can't run government that way. The notion that there has to be this ongoing micromanagement and supervision of the executive branch. I see, you know, we could discuss dismissals one by one if we'd like. I think Andy drew the line in an area where a dismissal would be improper. There'd be the legal authority to do it, but it would be criminal in nature if done to obstruct an ongoing investigation. Beyond that, I think the categories Mark set forth are helpful, and I agree, especially with the last one. If you're unhappy with the fact of a closed prosecution or a failure to investigate, we don't really like that, short of some sort of malfeasance in what was done. Mark, I'm not quite sure I heard on your loyal Bushies whether you said that was permissible or impermissible. I assume you said impermissible, but I didn't quite.
You mean for political sort of felty?
Yeah.
At the very least, unseemly.
Yeah. All I would say there is I think the documentary record indicates that term loyal Bushies was a shorthand for adherence to the administration's law enforcement priorities. I don't think there's any indication that we're looking to see whether someone was, giving political support or doing other things in a partisan way. So I don't think that category exists. Now, of course, there have been a couple election corruption investigations, election-related investigations in connection with some of the dismissals. And it's clear, for example, that there were improper contacts made by certain people on the Hill with U.S. Attorney Iglesias. It's equally clear that U.S. Attorney Iglesias improperly responded to at least one of those contacts, telling Senator Domenici the status of one of his investigations, and that he further failed to report to the Justice Department as he should have. But in terms of, there is no significant evidence from which one could make the judgment that the administration dismissed Iglesias because of how he handled that investigation. Rather, it appears that Senator Domenici was his sponsor. Senator Domenici over time got very unhappy with him over a variety of things, And, you know, if a powerful senator says, this guy is not doing a good job in my judgment, that's going to be, you know, it's not surprising that that would be enough. Let me briefly address the CRS report that Mark referred to. I acknowledge I haven't read the report, but I will say that it's clear that previous administrations handled these matters, shall we say, more deftly. I was talking the other day with someone in the Reagan administration who said that you would never know when U.S. attorneys were dismissed for some of these reasons because the deputy attorney general would quietly go out and visit them, and next day they would resign. So I think it's impossible, really, for a CRS to be able to assess how many U.S. attorneys were dismissed for what reasons over time. Of course, it's going to be the I think it's a better practice what was done in the past where there was clear misbehavior. I think, for example, one prosecutor in the Clinton administration bit a stripper. There's a number of problems there. It's clear that where there is public misbehavior, the administration is going to be more likely to make clear publicly that it's dismissing the U.S. attorneys. But what I want to do really is focus on the conflict between congressional oversight and executive privilege, because I think we have a hyper-exaggerated notion of what Congress's so-called oversight authority is. Now, let me make clear, Congress has broad investigative authority in support of its general legislative responsibilities. Basic notion is if Congress is going to be able to legislate wisely, it needs to be able to get the facts relevant to that investigation. I don't dispute that at all. That certainly includes information in the possession of the executive branch. Congress's authority includes the power to issue subpoenas for witnesses and documents. That the oversight label itself is confusing, and that it seems to suggest that Congress oversees the executive branch, as though rather than Congress and the executive branch being coordinate branches, that Congress has some broad supervisory authority detached from its legislative responsibilities. In practice, this is rarely going to make a difference, I think, in terms of the scope of oversight authority, but here is one instance, I think, where it really does. I'm going to quote from Justice Harlan's majority opinion for the Supreme Court in a case called Barenblatt v. United States. This is 1959. He's referring here to Congress's, what we call now Congress's oversight authority. Broad as it is, the power is not, however, without limitations, since Congress may only investigate into those areas in which it may potentially legislate or appropriate. It cannot inquire into matters which are within the exclusive province of one of the other branches of the government. Now, here, the power to remove U.S. attorneys is plainly a core presidential power. I don't think anyone here disputes that. What is Congress's legislative interest? Well, I think we can identify two conceivable interests. Mark referred to the amendment to the statute governing appointment of interim U.S. attorneys that was made by Congress. Last year, that amendment, as Mark indicated, enabled presidents to make appointments of interim U.S. attorneys for an indefinite period, whereas previously it had been the case that the presidential designation would last for 120 days. Followed by some sort of, I think, a chief judge designation. It's clear that change would give any administration some additional incentive to displace existing U.S. attorneys. U.S. attorneys, who, as Andy indicated, are there primarily because of the political influence of home state senators in the first place, and not because of their abstract merit as prosecutors. So we sure hope there's a combination of merit and politics. We sure hope there's merit combined with the politics that gets them there. But I don't see, especially now that there's an agreement that the changes can be repealed, what the conceivable legislative interest is here that justifies investigation subpoenas. What possibly are you going to find out? I just don't see it. There's, of course, a broader interest in appropriations for the Justice Department, but again, it seems to me any interest here is attenuated and feeble. By contrast, the interest in executive privilege, I think, is strong and robust. I was here a month ago for a Federal Society panel that we had on executive privilege versus congressional oversight. One of the most interesting things to me about that panel discussion, which I moderated, was that Walter Dellinger, who was, among other things, the Assistant Attorney General heading the Office of Legal Counsel in the Clinton administration, made a strong case for how underappreciated the interest in the confidentiality of executive branch deliberations is. The Supreme Court has recognized this interest in executive privilege. As stated in United States v. Nixon, the reasons for the deliberative process component of the privilege are plain. Quote, human experience teaches that those who expect public dissemination of their remarks may well temper candor with a concern for appearances and for their own interest to the detriment of the decision-making process. Now, I'll add further that if push comes to shove and somehow any of this ever ends up getting litigated, I think it's clear under D.C. Circuit law that the executive branch will win hands down. Under D.C. Circuit law, the committee issuing the subpoena would have to show that the subpoenaed evidence is demonstrably critical to the responsible fulfillment of the committee's functions. I just see no way that case can be made. More than that, there's been a real short-circuiting of the accommodation process that usually takes place when Congress wants information. Committees in both houses rushed to issue subpoenas. This would seem driven more by politics than a genuine interest in sorting out what information might be made available. Usually what you have is an informal request for information. The executive branch then says, what do you really need? There's this somewhat elaborate dance where things are worked out, information is given, and you never even get to the subpoena stage. Instead, there was a race to issue subpoenas. The administration then responded with, you know, this letter that said, oh, we'll provide witnesses only under these circumstances. I actually think the administration has gone far further than it should have already, both with the document dumps that made available initially and with the offer to make witnesses available. But that obviously is a reflection of how badly bungled the whole communications operations has been on this matter. So, again, my bottom line points are that I don't think that there's, if you look at the stuff that has become available so far, that there's anything seriously suggesting anything scandalous. Again, might that mean that if you did a scorched earth investigation, you'd come up with something? Sure, I don't think that's how we ought to proceed. And more particularly, if you look in terms of Congress's legitimate interest in getting information, I don't think that there's been any significant showing there. This is a supposed scandal that is, I think Smith said, oh, it's worse than a crime, it's a blunder. Well, I'm not going to say that blunders are worse than crimes, but this has been a blunder more than anything else, and it's understandable that people are trying to score political points on it, but it just doesn't seem to me that this has the makings of any serious constitutional crisis or even of any substantive controversy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Professor Turley.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you and the Federalist Society for putting together another interesting panel. The Federalist Society has performed for years a really fantastic role in bringing together different voices and on the same issue, and certainly you're seeing that here today. I'm going to do something that is unbelievably uncharacteristic and, in fact, could get me thrown out of the academic academy, and that is I'm actually going to yield most of my time in the interest of questions because we have only 25 minutes, and I think that the questions may be as interesting as anything that I might have to say. What I would say is that, you know, I have to admit as an academic, I tend to take a very robust view of congressional authority. I believe that's what the Federalists wanted. I believe James Madison wanted that even though we have three co-equal branches, really the engine of the Madisonian democracy is the legislative branch. And I supported the Republicans during the Clinton administration and many of their subpoenas and efforts to get information. And to some extent, I support the Democrats in their effort. When it comes to oversight, courts do not slice that particular salami very thin. They recognize that Congress has oversight authority for both the functioning of the U.S. government and the control of its appropriations. I can count on one hand the number of cases where courts have questioned that authority. All of those tend to deal with the extent of executive privilege, which I'll deal with in a second. I think that we have to deal with reality, which is something that, frankly, this White House could use a dose of. This, it is true, is a controversy brought forth by perfectly moronic decisions by the administration. I'm absolutely astonished at how bad the administration has performed in this controversy. I'm astonished because I have respect for many people in the administration, and I don't know how you can have this train wreck, because this is not one train wreck. This is a train wreck in which people rush to the scene and then crash the train again. And they keep on doing so until someone, by the love of God, will stop them. And I just, I don't understand it, quite frankly, but I think that the reason this has happened is there's no center of gravity on this issue. Someone who is directing it and bringing forth a coherent, single position. But I don't take a side in this. As many of you may know, I come to these things just to watch the cars crash. But I got to tell you, I think the administration's wrong in pushing this issue. It is not that they're wrong that they cannot win executive privilege on some of these questions. They can. They can, if they go to court, they will be able to protect some of these intra-office communications. They will not be able to protect most of the communications in this controversy. The Congress has a pretty good footing here. I mean, a lot of people don't like to admit it, but it's there. I mean, they have one U.S. attorney, former U.S. Attorney Iglesias, who's actually alleged that he was forced out to stop his investigation. You have at least two others that were involved in investigations that were controversial, two of whom have said that they received phone calls that they consider to be pressuring them to go in one direction or chastising them and not taking that direction. There is a legitimate question here of obstruction. I don't consider that the most serious. Congress has a much better one. False statements have been given to Congress. I mean, that's really good to go in terms of what Congress needs. Because of the just continual blunders of this administration, they have been given information that is misleading at best and potentially false. And they were told point blank that politics had nothing to do with these removals, that this was all performance related. Having looked at the evidence that we see so far, that doesn't appear to be true. Now, as you know, it's a problem when you say untrue things to Congress. And what happens is that when you make that very basic mistake, you trigger more authority by Congress. Now, when you add into this mix with the obstruction and the perjury allegations, people like Monica Goodling invoking the privilege against self-incrimination, it gets worse. I mean, the fact is she has every right to do that. But to invoke the Fifth Amendment, you're saying that you're afraid if you testify, you may incriminate yourself with regard to crimes. Now, that's obviously going to ratchet this up further, and it also assists Congress in some of the arguments that it's making. So if this goes to court, how is it going to turn out? Well, it's going to be there a long time. You know, George Bush may be back in Texas as a private citizen by the time it's over. But past presidents have been very leery, very cautious before they have litigated executive privilege. They have much more to lose than Congress in litigating executive privilege cases. And for that reason, past White House counsels have cautioned only to take the strongest possible cases to court. Nobody I know thinks that this is a really strong case in comparison to other cases that have been brought. The biggest problem is the administration has not only inconsistent answers, but they've pegged out a terrible legal and political basis to fight this. I mean, I think the DNC could not have designed this better for themselves. I mean, the way that I now understand it is that the administration is arguing that it's going to allow White House officials to disclose intra-office communications to senators and to members of the House. But They won't let that occur under oath and with a transcript. Who came up with that idea? Do you really think that a court is that's going to resonate with a court? Well, that must be what executive privilege is all about. Here's the much more likely approach for a court. A court's going to say executive privilege is supposed to prevent disclosure. It is supposed to protect you from disclosing to members of Congress. You put yourself in a rather bad position when your position starts out with make the disclosure, just don't make it under oath. Now, I got to tell you, I take a view of the executive privilege that whether you make a statement under oath or on a transcript has very little to do with the executive privilege. It's true, you could argue that by doing this we put more pressure on future executive branch officials. But I don't know of any case in which a federal court has ever said this is what executive privilege is about. It's to protect executive branch officials from the threat of perjury if they lie to Congress. Now, I may be wrong, and God knows I've been wrong in my life, but I doubt a court's going to say that. So the administration is going to be able to prevail on some executive privilege claims, but this is a bad one. It was badly crafted. I agree that they might have had a stronger case by just saying, you're getting nothing when it comes to intra-office communications. But their current position is almost nonsensical on a constitutional basis. And I'm very surprised. Now, the only thing I can guess, because Fred Fielding is a very smart guy, the only thing I could guess is this was not his final and best offer. And perhaps the president went off script when the reporter sort of got into his face and said, is this your final and best offer? And you asked that question to George W. Bush, and the answer most often is going to be yes, he's just that type of guy. And I, when that question was asked, I could almost feel Fred Fielding just sort of sinking in his chair because this does not look like any final and best offer I've ever seen on an executive privilege claim. Now, to give some credibility, I was equally harsh with the Clinton administration, perhaps even more harsh with the Clinton administration. But I think that this administration is making a real mistake in fighting on the ground it's pegged on. I think constitutionally, it at best will come out with a partial victory. And that's not enough if you ask most people that take a responsible approach to protecting executive privilege. Remember, executive privilege is not mentioned in the Constitution. It is a creation of the courts in reading the meaning of Article 2. So it can rise or fall by judgments. And if I was the White House counsel, I would go to the president and say, Mr. President, I'll litigate this if you want, but this is a bad case that's going to make bad law, not just for you, but future presidents. So we finally end up with the question of whether Congress is legitimate in demanding oaths and transcripts and calling White House officials. The answer is, in part, they're clearly within their rights to demand testimony from Justice Department officials. They have total oversight over the Department of Justice. They control their budget. And I don't believe any court is going to question all those witnesses. Now, when it comes to intra-office White House communications, I think that's a problem. But I will remind you that in Nixon, the Supreme Court said that even with the clearest core communications with the president, not with other people in the White House, but with the president, it is only presumptively privileged. It can be overcome by a showing of Congress. Now, whether this would make it out, I think it's their best argument. I got to tell you, the deliberative process privilege that people keep on talking about, I think is probably a loser. It is a creature of common law. It is not a creature of the Constitution. And it is more easy for Congress to attack. If they're going to win, they're going to have to win on the classic executive privilege case. And this is not a classic executive privilege assertion. And that's where I'll probably end and see if you have any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we open it up to questions? And
I don't think that Jonathan and I are really in that much disagreement. I just want to clarify. I'm not recommending that the executive branch fight an executive privilege battle. Perhaps my remarks go to the point that the whole thing should have been played differently than it has been. But I don't think at this point the way to resolve this is through court battles. I do think there are some exaggerated notions of what congressional oversight is, but I don't disagree with the bulk of what Jonathan had to say on
executive. Yeah, and there wasn't a criticism in it anyway. Yeah.
Why don't we open it up to questions, and before you state your question, wait for the microphone to be presented, because we're podcasting this, and we want to get everything on the tape audibly. Yes, Juan Carlos Benitez in the back.
Yeah, I have a question regarding, and this, I'll address it to all of you, but it's sort of interesting. There are a couple of terms known as career professionals, on a permanent basis for the U.S. attorney jobs, and it really is concerning to me, not only because of this last issue, or if there's an advocacy going on and making U.S. attorney positions a career position during the Clinton administration. And for me, this is very interesting. He had over 10 U.S. attorneys that were deputy U.S. attorneys that he named as acting U.S. attorneys for those offices that lasted all 8 years without one single name going to the U.S. Senate, not one single form being filled out. But they served as U.S. attorney through that entire period. In fact, the my favorite cases were the cases of Puerto Rico and Guam, where Guillermo Hill even passed to the Bush administration, and Fred Black, and both argued that they should be left there because they were conducting political investigation now into a third term. So I'm sort of going, is it the advocacy that you're all going for, that it should be a permanent career appointment, or is it everybody confirmed that it is okay for them to be political appointments that are done by the president and that can be changed by the president? That's one. The second one, which for me is very interesting, is as everybody keeps arguing that a lot of this firings were done because they were doing criminal cases, it comes to mind for me one name, Alex Acosta. He was appointed as an interim U.S. attorney using the same power that we're talking about, and he was the lead U.S. attorney doing the Abramoff investigation that I don't think any other investigation was more damaging to getting Republican congressional members out there. Then why wasn't he in this list of people that were being fired for prosecuting criminal cases against Republicans?
Well, just to elaborate on the first question also, because it was something I was thinking of during the presentations, there is a debate here about the extent to which prosecutors should be insulated from the political world, and how you strike the balance between independence and accountability in the political world to achieve integrity. So I think that's something that we might want to think about a little bit. I mean, in many parts of the country, prosecutors are elected, local and state prosecutors, state AGs, and a lot of the press seems to suggest that there's a high level of insulation here that is necessary. And I'd be curious, following on to Juan Carlos's question, your thoughts on that as well.
You know, I think, first of all, again, it's the president's power. And the only way that the president can actually set priorities is if the political process is able to influence the legal process. I think much has been said, and frankly overblown as a practical matter, in terms of what the effect of removing a United States attorney is on sensitive, ongoing investigations. I must tell you that having seen 6 changes of regime in New York, I can't remember a single time when the removal of the current United States attorney and installation of a successor United States attorney derailed an investigation, and in particular a sensitive corruption investigation. For the most part, the way United States attorneys' offices work day to day, and particularly the way casework is done, is not political. I mean, New York, we did Republican indictments. We did Democratic indictments. The people who worked together on cases, if you were outside the ambit of them wearing their prosecutor's hats, some of them were liberal Democrats, some of them were, right-wing Republicans. I never recall it really getting in the way of people actually doing their jobs as prosecutors, and I never recall the change of regimes derailing any investigations. But I do think it's important that the political process is able to influence the legal process, because that's the only way that people can be sure, that voters can be sure, that their enforcement priorities are going to register with the political leadership and the people who execute the police power, which is important.
Any other comments from the panel?
Well, I think that you can be sure that there are about 100 senators who will not let their patronage opportunity for U.S. attorneys disappear. And I think the idea of career U.S. attorneys is a bad one anyway. You also raised the point about the Vacancies Reform Act, which is an alternative means of filling vacancies. You end up with acting U.S. attorneys as opposed to interim ones being appointed. And it's an interesting point, because in a lot of cases, the Senate's confirmation power can effectively be evaded through the Vacancies Reform Act as well.
Other questions? In the back there.
Jeremy Stein, and I have a question that goes to this Patriot Act provision that modified the means by which replacement U.S. attorneys would be placed in office. And I view it as one of the more underreported aspects of the story. I know a couple of you alluded to it, and just as a, I guess, something of an academic exercise to see how significant, you know, it is in the story, I'd pose to each of you the question, do you realistically think the administration would have acted the same way had that provision never been put in place, and therefore had the operating assumption been that, well, we can remove these guys, but the replacements beyond the 120-day statutory period are going to have to go through the traditional Senate confirmation process? I mean, would it have been the case realistically that all of these U.S. attorneys would have been fired? Thank you.
No. I could elaborate. I doubt seriously that if they were subject to Senate confirmation, that Karl Rove's assistant would have replaced the Arkansas U.S. attorney when the assistant had very little relevant experience for the job. He would have been eaten alive in confirmation. He's indicated that he's not going to submit himself to confirmation. And I think there's little question about that. The other important thing about that provision is there was no need for it. There never was a need for it. The average period in the prior Congress for the confirmation of a U.S. attorney was 71 days. There were only three U.S. attorneys in the prior Congress that were not confirmed within 120 days, and two of them, it was a matter of just a couple of days. There was no need for this provision. It's astonishing to me how many senators voted on the Patriot Patriot Act and didn't know the provision was in there. It's a nice job if you can get it, but very few of them actually read the bloody thing. No, I think the answer is clearly no.
Based on what I know, I likewise doubt that all eight would have been replaced. As I stated, I think it's obvious that the Act creates an incentive to displace U.S. attorneys. And I'll limit myself to the further observation that I think, like Jonathan, I wish that Congress and folks voting on legislation would read it and know what's in it. Before they start trying to oversee the entire operations of the executive branch, it'd be good if they did their jobs.
Well, that's a fair observation, and I think we all agree on this, that it was put in place in a manner that could only institutionalize bad practices. I don't agree that Congress bears the entire blame for this, because this is one of those midnight provisions that was slipped into the conference report with no discussion. We know, in fact, that it was put in the conference report by an assistant to Senator Specter at the 11th hour with no discussion. Senator Specter himself apparently was unaware of it. It was done at the behest of the Department of Justice. And as a footnote, the gentleman who did that, a fellow named Brett Tolman, longtime Capitol Hill staffer, was appointed to a vacancy as United States Attorney for the District of Utah.
Let me just register some dissent from the apparent harmony up here on this particular issue. I don't disagree that it's not the best statute, but I do think it does address something that was a problem. It didn't address it in a particularly good way. The interim provision that it replaced allowed the United States courts to basically install a United States attorney in the event that the interim United States attorney chosen by the Attorney General did not win confirmation in a certain period of time. I guess it was 4 months, if I'm remembering right. That's inappropriate. The United States courts shouldn't be choosing the top executive branch law enforcement official in a district. Now, where I think they went wrong, and I do agree with my co-panelists on this, it's no more appropriate for the executive branch to be using a procedural vehicle, even if it's one that Congress gave to them this way, to undermine the Senate's constitutional responsibility to confirm United States attorneys than it would be for Congress to use its, or the Senate to use its arcane rules to fail to vote on nominees that the president selects. I don't think the gamesmanship on either side is good. But the way this could have been done better would have been if you couldn't get your interim appointed by a certain period of time to allow the executive branch to then, you know, that guy's got to be out and the executive branch can put in somebody else and he serves a small period of time and either gets confirmed or doesn't. But I think it's inappropriate for the court to be making this selection. And to the extent that there was that people were unhappy with the way things were previously done, it was because the court was the one doing the selecting.
Jonathan. Well, the only caveat I would add to that is that while the administration may not have liked the prior system, it had the law on it was relatively clear. Since Morrison versus Olson, the Supreme Court has accepted precisely that type of joint judicial legislative scheme. Now, you might not like Morrison v. Olson. You may want to try to overturn it. But the law as it existed was on good case law. And also, there are inherent powers within the courts recognized by the Supreme Court to guarantee that prosecutors are in place for the institution of justice. But putting all that aside, even if you had all those problems, the solution here was obviously a bad one, that you could have someone that could run the course of their term without coming up for confirmation. There were a host of other possibilities rather than taking that particular road.
Very briefly, if I may, Jonathan, I think the provision was constitutional, the one that existed. Whether it was a good idea or sound as a policy matter is a different point. I share Andy's views on that. I think it would have been better to come up with some other scheme that avoided the defect of an indefinite appointment.
Yeah, I also wonder, after 25 years of independent prosecutors and our experience with that, whether Morrison v. Olson would be decided the same way today as it was when it came down.
No, I think every liberal agrees with the opinion of Justice Scalia in that case, that Morrison was indeed wrongly decided. I do agree with Jonathan, though, that this would be upheld, and I guess the problem is finding another mechanism that would not reinforce the problem. The difficulty with giving sequential appointments to the executive branch is that there appear to be no end to the number of eligible claimants, and you could simply cycle them through every 120 days. I don't think that would serve the interests of sort of stability and consistency, let alone confirmability. So I think the purpose of interjecting the court, while it may not be a perfect solution, it's the best neutral we have available from another branch altogether. And the purpose of it is not for the court to make that appointment. It's for the court not to have to. It's to force the issue back to where it belongs, and that's the political give and take of the selection and confirmation process.
I'd suggest a better scheme would be to have an interim U.S. attorney require that person be nominated if he's going to serve longer than X days, and if the Senate doesn't want that person to continue to serve, it votes down the nomination. And once it's voted down, that person can't continue to serve.
Final question.
Hi, Rachel Tripp. Actually, this is, I guess, to everybody. assuming you could, this is clearly a train wreck, so assuming you could give advice with privilege, what would you advise to get the administration out of this train wreck? How can this be solved?
Quick, rapid-fire answers to this so we can close it on time.
Well, the easiest compromise is to save face. They could offer to let them testify in a public hearing without an oath. Congress still has a legal basis to force truthful testimony because 18 U.S.C. 1001, it's still a crime to lie or mislead to Congress. You really don't need the oath, and that would save face. But at this point, the White House has got to, you know, give up the ghost on some of these guys. Because it's pegged out really bad political and legal ground, and I think that's one obvious compromise.
Ed, any advice?
I think Attorney General Gonzalez is testifying on Thursday. He needs to be know his stuff inside out and explain why politics, properly understood, broadly understood, can play a role in these, and make clear that the narrow category that I think Mark identified was not in place here, and reconcile, as I think he can, the not particularly adept comments that have been made today.
Well, I'm tempted to say they need a surge. They definitely need to do something, and I think what I would recommend in all good faith would be for them to declare a settlement and simply say this has simply gone further than anybody meant it to go. It's nonsensical have them testify not under oath when, as Jonathan pointed out, they are still subject to the sanctions, not to perjury, but to sanctions for misrepresenting and misinforming Congress. I think not to have a transcript is absurd. In terms of public relations, they should say, fine, we're going to do it. We have nothing to hide. And by the way, we have a new attorney general.
I actually don't think this process was as crazy as it it's a public relations disaster, undoubtedly, but it was used during the 9/11 commission hearings, the lack of an oath and the lack of a transcript. I think at this point the only way to salvage this, if it's salvageable, is they should put out exactly why these people who were removed were removed. And if it turns out that it wasn't performance-related, then whoever said it was ought to be fired, and then go from there.
And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much to the panelists for joining us, and thank you for coming this morning.